It's a lot of pressure in a way to do that in the face of all the things that, you're having to eliminate.
It's really easy for a new foundation to be outcome oriented.
Yeah.
Gets harder about the time the outcomes are due.
It's early, but do you have a sense of how it is that you're going to try to look at the impact that you're having?
We're not focused on outcomes. When we think about bottom-up and emergence and collaboration and connectivity, that it is generally impossible to predict the outcome of the interaction of all those processes. That the concept of emergence, which, you know, we think in terms of complex human social systems. And if you think about how these human social systems interact, and in the science of complex adaptive systems, that you wouldn't be predicting outcomes. In fact, you want emergence from that, from the bottom up. And we believe that, you know, as far as outcomes are concerned, not only are they unexpected, but they are better off when they evolve from that process, that when individuals interact with each other, that the more they interact, the more they connect, the more they collaborate, the better the idea gets, the better the outcome gets. But we don't have to predict the outcome. It's going to happen. If you get the process right, the outcome will be there. And that's what we believe in. And that's going to be the approach to our work.
Certainly one of the principles of democracy. I think the best article I ever read about outcomes in philanthropy was actually an article in the New Yorker magazine by the medical writer about the government's 30-year war on cancer. It was full of many of the points both of you have made. And it basically said that, you know, we started out in the early 70s with a theory, a hypothesis about how we were going to tackle cancer. We're going to put billions of dollars into the war on cancer, and we were going to win this war, right? And if you actually looked back across the 30 years and you saw where the key discoveries were, they were, the hypothesis was wrong, and they were all on the edges outside where it was actually driven. Sally, data.
Well, we're taking a more familiar approach, I think, in developing our logic model and trying to align our core beliefs and assumptions, really Jeff's core beliefs and assumptions, around the growing disparity between rich and poor, the breeding ground for ill that cultivates, social entrepreneurs as the leveraged change agents for bringing about the changes that can bootstrap people out of poverty, that can seed hope where there is despair and hopelessness. And that is all driving toward, I think, a very tough outcome, which is ultimately hope. We see that the greatest enemies of positive change in the world are apathy and despair. Just think for a moment about how you felt reading the paper this morning, how you felt watching the news last night. What you think about America at this moment. And you realize that the danger is our retracting, our giving up, our surrendering. It's too complex, it's too difficult, the forces are too powerful, we can't do anything. And so we see that the social entrepreneurs whom we back and the thousands of others of these activists in the world are a very good reason to hope. And that's what our Connect and Celebrate strategies are all about, to bring these people together, to bring them together with others who can invest in them, who can empower them, who can join forces with those of us who are backing them because they generally don't have access to sufficient resources to bring about the kinds of changes that are so promising that they're developing. The Celebrate agenda too is to bring their stories into media, into film, into documentaries, into television, so people can find out about them, so people have a reason to hope, can move from the sidelines into the fray and get behind good people doing good things in the world. And my colleagues at the foundation and some very smart people out in the world have promised me and promised Jeff that we are going to be able to measure hope. But I say if we can measure the consumer confidence in the economy, surely we can measure humanity's hope for the planet. So that's what we're committed to trying to do in some way, and that's what's at the end we're going to be accountable for.
So just a quick redirect to you, Lou. I mean, you said a very fascinating thing about money sitting on the sidelines, kind of waiting to see whether this philanthropy thing is, I mean, is it sitting on the sidelines because people don't believe it's effective, or is it sitting on the sidelines for another reason?
Well, I mean, I think the logic model in terms of the economics of philanthropy are fairly simple. If you have a lot of money, you decide how much you want to spoil the kids and how much you want to pay the government. What's left is what winds up going into philanthropy in today's structure in one form or another. I think we could all probably in this room think of a quick $100 billion that's available to philanthropy that is not here. And if you look carefully at where it is, you're looking at a group of people who did not grow up as philanthropists, who do not come from many generations of philanthropy, who managed through a particular set of skills and risk-taking to develop a fortune in our structured economy in a relatively short period of time. A lot of these people have a definition of results that doesn't necessarily fit social issues that well. And I think that it's sort of up to all of us in our various ways to show them that philanthropy can make the kind of difference that they can sense in their lifetime, not in necessarily their grandchildren's lifetime.
I think the projections, Catherine, are something like $10 to $40 trillion over the next 30 to 40 years, which is going to transfer. And much of this transfer is coming from an older generation. And it does remain to be seen how much of that does go into philanthropy. So I would really echo what Lou says. I think that we need to tell our story and to make it convincing.
A number of you talked about partnership and collaboration. Two sort of related sides of that coin. What are the obstacles to it, and how are you working to overcome them? So how are you encouraging it? Just say a little bit about your desire to work with others, and anybody want to take that first off?
Well, I mean, you know, it depends on how you define collaboration, and there's a lot of literature about collaboration. From our perspective, collaboration is, in fact, fundamental to the approach to our work. So we don't think about if we should collaborate or if others should collaborate. It is, in fact, a given. If you don't collaborate, you won't get the kind of outcomes you're looking for.
And we're collaborating with our grantees. We're collaborating with other foundations. We collaborate with people. Social Edge is our online community for the social sector. And it really invites people around the world to collaborate, to share their ideas, to share their experiences, to build knowledge, to point people to other websites that have the information that they're seeking. And as we have developed this platform, we reach out to the community and to our peers and folks around the world in thinking about and developing Rev2. So we, you know, in every way imaginable, we're trying to partner, to reach out, to connect, and to reap the benefits of the thinking and the experience of others.
Just a quick comment on a portion of collaboration, and that's this issue of collaborating with other grant makers. All of you who make grants probably realize that the success of your grant, regardless of how you measure it, is probably more dependent upon everybody else's grant in the field than it is on what you do. There's a marketplace out there which is going to add or subtract capacity, create competitors, not create competitors, fund the most marginal actor or fund the most important actor. And so it's very hard to think about being in a field without truly understanding what everybody else is doing in that field. And that requires a lot of collaboration. It should be easy, because essentially in the foundation business, we're not in business to take credit, we're in business to give credit. And that essentially gets you over a substantial amount of the hurdles. But I am always surprised at how much invented here winds up coming about when you're looking in the field of what other foundations are doing. We do a lot of work in the Amazon. Consulting firm took a look at what else was going on in the Amazon, and we discovered, much to our surprise, that we were 60% of the money going into environmental projects in the Amazon basin, which immediately said, when's the last time we talked to the 40%? We did with a good collaboration with Hewlett and Packard and Goldman and ourselves and the state of California and the federal government, we purchased the salt flats in the south part of the bay, a big portion of the environment here. Each actor had sort of a different part in the process. But what the four foundations wound up doing, I think unexpectedly, was that it kept the 100 nonprofits in the Save the Bay group at bay long enough to get the deal done, mostly because they didn't want to piss all of us off at once. A strange role, but an extremely important collaboration.
I know you all have living donors and need to be responsive to them, but if there was one thing you could do or change that was solely your idea, that didn't rely on their approval, what would it be?
So, when you have a founder like we do, where there is a fair amount of very open, bottom-up thinking, the process by which we come to decisions is not a process which is driven from top down. It is not Pam and Pierre. Bottom-up is the voices of the people in the field, the people who are the participants who can effect real change. It is their voice, when expressed, results in how Omidyar Network will fund. So we don't even have a dialogue about this is what I want done and it shall happen.
I worked for 17 years in the area of informal learning and the children's museum world, and it's a fascinating world, and I think really taught me a lot about how powerful ideas and innovations scale. I didn't realize that at the time, but you know, the first children's museum was founded in 1899. There were a handful of them in the early part of the century. In the 60s, the movement started to take off. I worked with Mike Spock in Boston at the children's museum there in the late 60s. Frank Oppenheimer was inventing the interactive science museum on the West Coast. Children's museums and interactive science museums have transformed the way museums approach exhibitry, reach out to their communities, and inspire families to learn. And that, you know, has created a profound movement internationally in the way museums are organized and built and structured. So I love museums. And I suppose if I could think of anything, it would be to invest in continued innovation in the museum field, because I believe that the way we all learn is through a whole network of informal learning resources. We don't learn everything we know in school. We learn it by doing, we learn it by connecting, we learn it by accessing all kinds of opportunities to learn throughout our lives. So I suppose I could get behind that.
There's probably a couple of things I'd change. That one of the most interesting ones is that Gordon in particular, who grew up in this community, is one of the ultimate entrepreneurs, has little faith in government as an institution. It's not uncommon in this part of the world to hold those values near and dear to your heart. Yet almost everything we do winds up bumping up against policy issues. It is hard to even get enough salmon coming up a stream without dealing with some absurd policy. And I guess if I could change something, I would spend a little bit more money on policy than we currently are.
Catherine, if I gave an answer, which obviously was an answer that is genuinely driven from the way we work and think, but at a very personal level, I would say, given my long career in healthcare, that one of the greatest challenges that we are facing as a society is, and it reminded me because of the issue that Lou just brought up about policy, is that we are clearly obstructed to what is looming out there as one of the greatest innovations of health sciences on the cusp of curing many, many diseases, and that's stem cell research. And this current policy of governments is absolutely resulting in what could become one of the greatest disasters to human mankind for the next century of how we deal with aging and disease. And so I would say that if I had a choice, I would be investing billions, not millions, into stem cell research, because the profound impact that that will have for millenniums to come of what we will discover from stem cell research.
Who are your role models or sources of inspiration?
Through my career, obviously, I have had the privilege of working with many, many outstanding human beings. But I had an opportunity to spend several years working with His Highness the Aga Khan, who many of you may know by name, who also operates one of the largest international foundations based out of Switzerland. And he has clearly been an individual who has been my mentor and inspirer and taught me the most powerful humanistic values that have now infused my DNA in how I think and how I work.
And for me, I would say it's John Gardner, and it's the great works of literature. My husband and I are reading Don Quixote to each other at night, and there's something about that ragged knight and his vision of himself and the world he wants to create and living that inspires me and gets me out of bed to fight that good fight. But John, whom I knew really for the last 15 years, was such a giant and yet so humble. You know, he was curious. He was interested in others. He believed when the evidence was, you know, there in spades, that there wasn't very good reason to believe. He argued that the problems are never solved, that nations and institutions must always be rebuilt, that the complex systems we all talk about and understand have to be nurtured, that the human species is at once very fragile and very resilient and robust, and that most of us as individuals, and certainly societies, never really develop the full potential of their capacity for good and their capacity for wonder and their capacity to make their neighborhoods, their communities, their nations, and the world better. And John Gardner is someone I go back to over and over again, and I think many people in this sector do.
Hard to answer because I think it changes in your life. There's been numbers of people and numbers of historical figures that I like to think about. Teddy Roosevelt, if I'm thinking about the environment. Gordon Moore, if I'm thinking about getting the business done. He's quite an inspiration. But my current inspiration is really my grandchildren. They're the hope, and that's what we're doing this for.
The older I get, the more interested I am in history. I guess I think that's kind of a normal thing. I'm going to answer that question by quoting Eleanor Roosevelt, as I often do. Actually, not quoting Eleanor Roosevelt, quoting Adlai Stevenson, who said at Eleanor Roosevelt's funeral, she would rather hold a candle than curse the darkness. I actually think that's what philanthropy is all about, and I want to thank everybody here who's carrying that candle.